We ready?
Yes.
Good afternoon, everyone. Shana Tova. I hope you had a beautiful Rosh Hashanah. It is great to be together again. And we're meeting now at a very awesome time between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And so we're going to focus specifically on this period, on the high holiday period, for our discussion regarding spiritual resistance in the Holocaust. Before we get into the rest of the year, when we'll deal with specific topics, I didn't Xerox it for you because I assume many of you have seen it. If you hadn't, I can send it to you. Before Rosh Hashanah, there was an article going around in the New York Times entitled "An Improbable Relic of Auschwitz, a Shofar That Defied the Nazis." So everybody saw this article? Okay, did you see this article?
Just the headline.
And it's the story of a... You didn't see it?
I didn't know. I don't know.
You're going to see it now.
Yeah, I've seen it.
There you go.
Pass it to
that. Oh, I didn't Xerox it because it's readily available. And it's the story of this Holocaust researcher whose father had a shofar in Auschwitz, which was being donated for a demonstration, for a museum, to express what we have been talking about for all these years, the idea of spiritual resistance. And so it was really a perfect segue to think about sparks, episodes, insights into this high holiday period, which of course only heightens and accentuates the tension and the challenge of religious and spiritual life, the awareness of God with the tragedy and the destruction that was happening, that challenge. We're going to look at a couple of examples of this, and then we're going to think about one approach of how to somehow how to begin to think about navigating that quandary of where is God during the high holidays, in the middle of all this, and then in the aftermath. So that first article you can take a look at. I can send it around. It's in the New York Times. If you open your packets, we have another piece that relates. We're going to go from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur. This episode is taking place here in this Shar Machmadim. This is the book translated into English of reflections by the Weizener Rav, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Meisels, who came here to Chicago. The story in that... Oh, Pierre. The end of the talk will get to you. Don't worry, I have something in mind. He asked me a question last time. I haven't forgotten it. We're going to get to you at the end. It's a good thing you showed up. Otherwise, you would be bereft of this answer for eternity. So that shofar they're talking about is from the fall of 1944. Then it was given to somebody else. That's the whole story. At the same time, in the same place, was another shofar. Now, is this possible? It is possible because, as you know, the camp was enormous and there were a lot of things that were going on under the noses of the Germans, unbeknownst to them, in various ways. So is it improbable? It's not so probable, but is it possible? It is possible. And did it happen? It did happen. Rabbi Meisels, he came from Weizen, which is a community in Hungary. Why is it that he's coming from Hungary now?
The deportations were...
That's right. This is the end of the deportations of Hungarian Jews. So just putting the context in your mind, who's being deported to Auschwitz at this period? Hungarian Jews, many of them from his own community, as he'll reference in the story, people he knew. He gets to Auschwitz. Long story, he has a shofar. And he describes about this period, about Rosh Hashanah, an episode that happened to him. Now, where you can use this in your tour, if you want to think about this, it might be in the area where you come down from the train and the deportation hall where people are, you know, being processed and sent to this place and sent to that place. So he describes that there was a barrack with 1,400 boys who were sealed off for 24 hours alone, with no food. Now, why was it that they would be sealed off by themselves but not taken care of? Because as we know, unfortunately, things were, excuse the term, was so busy that they couldn't kill everybody that they wanted to kill at one time, lo aleinu. So you had these 1,400 men who were designated, they were going to be gassed, but they're in this barrack. They're all by themselves. And somehow, you know, people are walking, they're coming, they're going, and they get word that the Weizen Rav has a shofar. So somebody tells somebody if they could co-send him, if he should please come to the sealed barrack with these boys to blow the shofar for them. So that already is like, that's what they're worried about. That's what they're looking for. So in his mind, he makes a calculation, what is the proper thing to do according to Jewish law? And he says, on the one hand, the proper thing to do in Jewish law is not to risk his own life and to go to a sealed barrack where it would be obviously instant death if he were ever to be caught. But he decided it's an emergency situation. It's an emergency. So he has to go to this barrack. So he goes to this barrack with his son, whose son, he stands outside and he watches to make sure that nobody's coming. And he goes in to blow the shofar. Who does he see in this room? People who he knew. Some of them had been his own students in his own yeshiva. Invites him. He comes in there. You see on page one, on the left side, there is not a writer or a poet in the entire world who can portray my feelings as I entered the sealed barracks. It was only due to the miracle of God that my heart did not burst in anguish when I saw before me the bitter sea of tear-stung eyes. All of the children were screaming and crying terribly with burning tears. And they reached out to him, Rebbe, Rebbe, Rachmanus, Rachmanus. So he was trying to get going. He wanted to blow the shofar for them, go to the top of the second column. But the boys would not let me continue, and at last I relented. So he had to give them a sermon. A sermon, if you can imagine. Focusing on the verse, Bakeset Leom Chageinu, which means it is hidden in the appointed time of the holiday. Why did he choose that verse? Bakeset, what is hidden? God is hidden. God is hidden. And that they shouldn't despair. And even if we're besieged on all sides, go to the next page. I looked up from the heavens, I look to the Lord. So then are the final words on the bottom of the next page, on page two. I cannot hold back the words. I tell the story so the future generations will know the great Mesiris Nefesh, that means self-sacrifice, and the fervently holy words that I heard from these young boys shortly before they were taken to the ovens. After the blowing of the shofar, as I was about to leave, one boy stood before me and cried out in great anguish, "Dearest of friends, the rabbi has strengthened us by telling us that even when a sharp sword is upon our throats, we should not despair of mercy. But I say to you, we can hope for the best, but we must prepare for the worst. For the sake of Hashem, my brothers, let us not forget in our last moments to cry out Shema Yisrael with sincere devotion." With heart-rending voices and burning passion, they cried out Shema Yisrael. Then another boy stepped forward and said, "We are not going to give the Rebbe a Yashar Koach for his great self-sacrifice, Mesiris Nefesh, in providing us with our last mitzvah." What are they concerned about? Their last thing on earth is that they should hear the sound of the shofar. "But all of us bless you that in this merit, God will help that the Rebbe will merit leaving this place alive and well." And all the boys answered, "Amen." And that was it. That's their last act on this earth. And so we need to remember this story, because when we think of the high holidays, the fact that we hear this shofar, this is not the first time the shofar is heard. The shofar has been heard even in these most difficult circumstances. On Rosh Hashanah, even in that context. Take a look on the next page. This is from the Farbstein Hidden in Thunder volume. Not just men, it's also women. Look on the left side, page 3. After Rabbi Yeshua Grunwald of Chust, go to the next paragraph. First he describes how he recited the Shemoneh Esrei and everybody followed him. There were also women who dictated the text of the prayers as they remember them from home. So it's not just rabbis, it's not just yeshiva boys, it's also average everyday women who had learned, had grown up, they had imbibed this from their mothers, from their parents, and it became part of them to the extent that they taught it to others. An old woman from Warsaw, the wife of a cantor, reconstructed the Rosh Hashanah prayers from memory. On the evening of the festival, after a long and exhausting day of labor, she recited the prayers aloud, and the women around her repeated them word by word. Let's turn to the next page. We mentioned this last time from Rav Shimon Huberband, Zichrono Levracha, Hashem Yikom Damo Zechus Yagon Aleinu. I want to make one note on this story, which we mentioned last time. This was right after the German invasion. He's in Pietrikov. There's tremendous tension. So first, on the bottom of page 4, on the left-hand side, in the middle, on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, he describes the chaotic scene that the shtiebels didn't have davening. They only had a shul with 20 people in it. But in the next paragraph, prayers were held in private apartments, and that's what he did in his apartment. So 6 o'clock in the morning, the neighbors from the courtyard and a few other places, they came, and they had davening. How long was the davening? How long? I don't know how many people here davened on Rosh Hashanah in a shul. Our davening was like 4.5 hours, 5 hours. How long was the davening in Rav Shimon Huberband's apartment, bottom left? Shacharis took 1/2 hour. Then they didn't sound the shofar because they were too nervous. They did the Torah reading and Musaf 1/2 hour. By 7:30, the whole thing was over. And yet, they stuck with it. Right? They found a way to adapt in the emergency situation to continue the davening. It wasn't the davening that they remembered from Pietrikov from last year, but this is the resistance. If it takes an hour, it takes an hour and a half, that's what it is. They had food, but they said, who could eat? The Germans were going house to house, searching around. Then they had the second day of the holiday. He says, I recited Maariv, the nighttime prayer, on the right-hand column halfway down, with no minyan. There was no new fruit. Many of us at home on the second night of Rosh Hashanah, we eat a beautiful new fruit. We say, thank God for bringing us to this time, the new fruit. He says, there's no fruit. No new fruit. So he said the Shechianu also, just that they live in this time. And he broke down in tears with his mother-in-law. They daven again the second day. But look what happens on the left side. Go to page 5. This is the part that I wanted to highlight today. This is so beautiful. We never focused on this before. So meanwhile, not only are they worried about the search from the Germans and they're dealing with davening and setting up their religious lives, so they're worried about themselves, but they're also worried about other people. So look at this. Look at this paragraph here on the third paragraph on the left side. Who wants to read my mother-in-law? Okay, Doris, go ahead.
My mother-in-law, being emotionally decimated and full of pain, didn't prepare any meals for the holiday. Our neighbors noticed this, seeing me eating bread and a salad consisting of onions, tomatoes, and herring. Every neighbor brought down an entire meal for me and offered it to me very kindly. I categorically refused.
All right, so let's hold it right there. The last thing somebody could have been thinking about is what somebody else's food situation is. You know, they barely had their life by the thread. Some of the people, that's when the rest of the paragraph he talks about, some people, they had been decimated by the bombing. But they had enough compassion, enough awareness of another Jew suffering that has less than them, that they see that they should have food for him. Right? It's amazing. Sometimes the like the overwhelming stories of incredible heroism are powerful. Blowing a shofar, endangering your life for 1,400 boys who say Shema Yisrael and then go to the gas chambers. That's an iconic, unbelievable, you know, once in eternity story. And then there's the small story that on Rosh Hashanah, who knows, these people, they may have had an inkling that this may be the last Rosh Hashanah. Who knows what was going to be. And yet, within that, all the horrible dread that was going on, they see a Jew who has less than them, a woman who's broken so she can't make a yontif meal for her family. So they say, I'll give you a little bit. The everyday kindness, how that shines through in this autobiographical sketch, I think it's so amazing. It's not just about the big moments, it's the small moments. So this is 1939, let's fast forward to 1940. Go to page 6. Some of us have seen this diary before. It's called Scroll of Agony, also a diary from the Warsaw Ghetto. What does he describe? Remember, this is before the ghetto. This is October 1940. The ghetto was not set up until a few weeks later, but they're still living under German conditions for over a year. So in the bottom left, he describes, we have no public worship, even on the high holidays. There is darkness in our synagogues, for there are no worshipers. Silence and desolation within, and sorrow looking on from without. Even for the high holidays, there was no permission for communal worship. I don't know whether the Judenrat made any attempt to obtain it, but if it didn't try, it was only because everyone knew in advance that the request would be turned down. Even in the darkest days of our exile, we were not tested with this trial. Never before was there a government so evil that it would forbid an entire people to pray. But never in our history, drenched in tears and blood, did we have so cruel and barbaric an enemy. And this was in 1940, when they didn't have any inkling of what was really coming. Lo Aleinu. Everything is forbidden to us. The wonder is that we are still alive and that we do everything. And this is true of public prayer too. It was forbidden that the Jewish soul does not die. They could take away the outside. They could crush the bones and burn them and incinerate them. But the soul, that doesn't die. Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, Rabbi Cook was the first chief rabbi of the modern settlement of Israel. He has a siddur. It was compiled by his son and his students called Olas Raya. Rav Cook has an introductory note where he says that the soul of a Jewish person is always davening. What does that mean? A soul, we have a tradition, Ner Hashem Nishmas Adam. The soul is like a candle. That's why on a yard site or during a shiva, they light a candle because that's the symbol of the Jewish soul. The heat of the flame is always rising. The soul of the Jew is always rising up to the heavens to commune, to connect with God. That's what it means. That inside, Rabbi Cook says, we're always praying. It's just that when we stop to speak to God, that's when it is expressed. But we're always, our soul is always reaching for something higher, something more meaningful, something spiritual to connect to God. You can't destroy that. That can never be broken. That exists within every Jewish heart. So these Jews said, we don't have a shul. Secret minyanim. Top of the next column. Secret minyanim. By the hundreds throughout Warsaw, organized services. And do not skip over even the most difficult hymns in the liturgy. So this is interesting, because in the case of Rav Shimon Huberband, I'm not sure if they finished all of Shacharis, the morning service, in a half hour because they skipped or because they went really, really fast. Now he's saying they don't even skip. They do the whole service. Everything. There is not even a shortage of sermons. Everything is in accordance with the ancient customs of Israel. When there is no informer at work, the enemy doesn't know what is going on, and we can assume that no Jewish man, even if he is a Jew born in Poland, would inform on Jews standing before their Maker in prayer. He says, no Jew is going to ever turn their fellow Jews in for davening on Rosh Hashanah. They pick some inside room whose windows look out onto a courtyard, which is similar to the story of Reb Shimon Huberman, because especially in a lot of these European neighborhoods, they had apartment buildings with courtyards. So they found a place where it wasn't so easy to see in what's going on over there. This time there are no cantors and choirs, only whispered prayers. But the prayers are heartfelt. It is possible to weep in secret too, and the gates of tears are not locked. And so we give praise to the God of Israel, who kept us alive and supported us and brought us to this season. During the year, many individuals drank the cup of hemlock. Many have gone to their graves. The community has been debased and impoverished, but it still exists. Let's go to Yom Kippur. And if it wasn't in the book, you wouldn't believe it. Gidon Greif's work, We Wept Without Tears. We've mentioned this a few times. The interviews that he did with the Sonderkommando. So this one is the section, I'll get out of here. This is with Yaakov Gabay. His family originally was Italian, but he was a Greek Jew, which is why he didn't arrive in Auschwitz until much later. And he's being interviewed about his experience. So in the context of everything he talks about his relationship with God, about even though he's not religious, he believes in God. That's a whole other story. And so then he's being interviewed about, did you ever have any vacation as a Sonderkommando? I don't know what the question meant. That's why it's in parentheses, in quotation marks. Were you certain? So first he asked, did he work on Sunday? Did you work on Sunday? He says, of course we worked on Sunday. Were you sometimes given a vacation from the work? I remember that Yom Kippur fell on October 4th, 1944. On the Monday evening, I saw the Polish Jews in the Sonderkommando getting everything ready. Torah scrolls, prayer books, etc. If this man had not been there, would you believe this? Never. Do you remember who was in the Sonderkommando? We mentioned someone who was there. Yes. The Dayan of Makov. He doesn't mention him by name. But I wonder if that great tzaddik, who we mentioned once a long time ago, who was a rabbinical judge, who was mentioned by another one, remember he was killed in November? I wonder if that rabbi was in this minyan. Who knows? Who knows? We don't have any documentation. We don't have any evidence. He just says Polish Jews. So remember, now how is it possible that Sonderkommando had these things?
From Canada?
And also, remember that they had relatively, you can't say normal, but they had relatively humane living quarters. Right? What did the Sonderkommando use when they had the uprising to burn down the crematoria? They used mattresses. They slept with mattresses. They had beds with mattresses. They had, you can't say anything about this is normal, but they had some kind of arrangement. So it wouldn't be crazy that the Sonderkommando had access to various things, and they also had where to hide and keep. And they had some kind of semblance of life that was going on where they lived. This is what he says. The Germans gave us a day off and we prayed. Everyone did what they had to. And the next day, Tuesday at 5 in the morning on Yom Kippur, they received a transport of 2,500 Jews. That was that. That was their Yom Kippur present. I still remember it well. I told my friends, look at what a present these bastards are giving us. 3 days later, the uprising of Crematoria 3, which is 4, broke out. So even here, in 1944, literally in the shadow of death, he says, I remember it. Polish Jews had some Yom Kippur, we would call today Kol Nidre Davening. And as he said, they did what they had to, because they had to pray. Let's go with one more example, and this you might use sometime. I only gave you two of the pages. This came from Yad Vashem. It's a new piece. This man by the name of Emil Newman, he was on the Kastner train. Now, there's a way, I didn't get a hold of it because the sections of the Kastner train transport script that I saw didn't have N, it had K, L, but you can get, I don't know where, but we probably could ask the museum, they could get for us. There are copies of the Kastner transport lists that are extant. You can get pieces of them online, but I bet the museum could get us if we wanted the whole thing. So we could find this guy. His name was, at that time, Emil Newman. His name now was Menachem Shimoni, who was put on the Kastner train, and we're not talking about Kastner today. That's a separate discussion. It's a quandary. And he was taken from Budapest. The Kastner train was going from Budapest to Switzerland, but they had a diversion. They made several stops, including for a period of time in Bergen-Belsen. They were put in a separate part of the camp where they stayed. They were separate prisoners, and then they continued on. The vast majority, a few of them did not survive, but the vast majority of them went from Bergen-Belsen on to Switzerland. His whole family survives, but it describes how he made a calendar from memory for the year 1944 to 1945. You see the calendar on the bottom. Now, look at the next page. What is that? Can you read it? That's right. This is from the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur service, Menachem Shimoni writing a machzer from memory. I have here more pieces. I didn't Xerox for you. They also have from Yad Vashem the selection from Kol Nidre Night that we sing, Kihine Kachomer B'Yad HaYotzer. We are like putty in the hands of the craftsman. This is the full Nisana Tokef prayer. B'Rosh Hashanah Yikasevun U'V'Yom Tzom Kippur Yechasemun. Amazing. Amazing, amazing. Written from memory in Bergen-Belsen and survives the war. This is original. This is not manufactured. This is the original original that you have in front of you. Any thoughts before we move to part two?
I asked a little difficulty, if I actually can explain it. Here we can see people at 1400 keys facing death. Forget about the conditions that they're living in, you know how difficult it was. And yet they recite Shepiano. If you get Shepiano on the surface, word by word meaning, what can they say?
Oh. This is the difficult question that was plaguing everyone. You're alluding to, Pierre is alluding to the question that was articulated directly by Rabbi Aronson, Rabbi Yehoshua Aronson, who was the rabbi before the war in Poland. He was after the war in Petach Tikva, and he wrote the volume, the Hebrew volume called Ale Meroros, Bitter Herbs, Bitter Leaves, with a diary that documented his travels. He was in Auschwitz for a bit. Sounds like a hotel, excuse me. He spent some time in Auschwitz, but a lot of his time was in a work camp in a place called Kunin, something like that. So they had a Seder in his barrack, and he asked the same question. How can we say Shehecheyanu? It's the age-old question. You know, how can you say Shehecheyanu? So a little bit was alluded to in that in the piece from the Scroll of Agony of, despite all of the horror, just to be alive. Or, as they said from the Kloisenberger Rebbe, that he made a bracha, maybe this was in the Yaffa Eliach tales, that before the person was killed, what did they say? Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam, Shelo Asani Goy. Shehecheyanu, that we still are Jews, that we still have God, that we still have ourselves. right? Because otherwise, what does it mean? How do we process that? It's kind of the segue to what you asked me the last time after we finished, which is what I want to talk about now, which is processing these conflicting experiences. Because during this period, today, when I go back to the Kollel and we daven Mincha in the Shemona Esrei in the service, we're going to say HaMelech HaKadosh, not HaKel HaKadosh, the awesome God. We're going to say God who's our King, the Holy King. Well, a king, in this context, has a specific connotation. It means all-powerful and present. One of the pieces, the passages, you don't have it in yours, but I have it here. You can see it here. Uvechein l'cho hakol yachtiru. And then it's a passage, l'keil orech din. It's part of the liturgy for Rosh Hashanah, Shacharis, the first day, Musaf, the second day, and Yom Kippur, I think it's in the morning, Shacharis. So l'chein, therefore, to you, God, we all coronate. God is the king. God is the melech in Hebrew. Well, the melech means all-powerful and omnipresent. Nothing stands in the way of the king. So how are we davening that nothing stands in the way of the king, and yet everything is happening to the king's children, the king's people? How do we deal with this? So there are many different ways that people have thought about this, far beyond my knowledge, but I wanted to introduce you to one person, and specifically in this context, because he was a shliach tzibur. He was the chazan, the leader of a congregation for many years on the high holidays. And he said, Uvechein l'cho kol yachtiru. And his name was Rabbi Yehuda Amital. Or you have it on the... There's a beautiful video. I'll show you for 1 second, if you can see. This, you can get it online later on. I can send you a link. So he grew up in Romania. His name was Klein. You see, this is him when he was an older man. He's a very radiant person. He was born in 1924 in Transylvania. He was taken to a labor camp where he remained for about 8 months. And on October 9th, of 1944, he was liberated by the Russians. You know what that day was? What's that? Early.
Yeah, very early.
Early. Let's have a pause it for a second. What was October 4th, 1944? Simchas Torah. Simchas Torah, 1944. His name was Yehuda, that comes to Israel. His name was Klein originally. He changes his name. Now his name is Yehuda Amital. What does the word Amital mean? Okay, Ami, my nation. What's that? Do. What is do associated with? There is a Midrashic tradition. It's associated with what? Rain. But there is another. What's that? Torah. There's actually a deeper level. There is, I think there is a mystical tradition that do is associated with Tchias HaMesim, the resurrection of the dead. So he's saying, Ami Tal, my nation is resurrected from the dead. Ami Tal. I don't know for sure. Probably it's in his book. I didn't read. He has an autobiography called By Faith Alone. It's probably there. I didn't read it yet. So Rav Amital comes to Israel. He studies in a very famous yeshiva called the Chevron Yeshiva, which was a very prominent yeshiva, which included many religious personalities of different viewpoints. Meaning, you had what today you would call more, I hate labels, they're terrible, but more like Haredi, old school Yeshuv HaYashan types of rabbis, but also people who became future chief rabbis of Israel. Rav Goren studied in Chevron Yeshiva. Some good heretics studied in Hebron. Like, it's a very diverse kind of place. My Rebbe once pointed out that If you don't have any heretics that graduated from your yeshiva, you're probably not a good yeshiva. You know what I'm saying? So Rav Amital studies and received smicha from one of the great rabbis of Yerushalayim, Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer, who was a prominent European rabbi who emigrated to Israel before the war. And then he founds one of the first yeshivot hesder, which means combining army service with Torah study, in Gush Etzion, right after it's liberated. It's entitled, it's called Yeshivat Har Etzion. And some of you have heard of this yeshiva. So Rav Amital started the yeshiva, and then shortly thereafter, he invited Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh Livracha, to join him, and they, for many decades, were the Rosh Yeshiva. Thank you for the video. So Rav Amital had hundreds and probably thousands of students, and he was the Shliach Tzibur, the main cantor for Yamim Noraim, for the high holidays in the yeshiva and Yeshivat Har Etzion, for these boys. Most of them were, you know, either they were Sabra boys, Israeli, or they were American yeshiva students. It was a totally new world. It's not, there's no Yiddish, there's no Alter Heim, it's all new. It's all new. And so Rav Amital is transplanting his old experience, his life experience, into and conveying it to these boys, some of whom are very good friends of mine. One year, my dear friend, he's a principal here, his name is Rabbi Menachem Linzer, he was a student of Rav Amital. He sent me before Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur some of the nigunim, some of the specific melodies from Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur from Rav Amital. Where did those melodies come from? They came from the high. They came from before. So Rav Amital was very aware of this tension that we're talking about. That on the one hand, God is the Melech. We believe in God. He's part of us. We have spiritual lives. We have religious lives. And on the other hand, there's the Holocaust. And it is a conundrum. The last public interview that Rav Amital gave, I didn't Xerox it for you because it's in Hebrew and it's a very difficult Hebrew, appears in this magazine. I don't even remember where I got this magazine from, but it's very valuable now. This magazine is called Eretz Acheret. It's not a religious magazine. It's an Israeli publication. This is from March, April 2009. This is a picture of Rav Amital, and it was the last interview that he gave about the Holocaust. He talks about his background and a lot of things, but he talks about the struggles that he has. The struggles of standing between belief and unanswered questions. And he has a phrase. He says, the title of this paragraph is La'amod Bifnei Kir.
To stand before a wall.
That's right. B'inyan HaShoah, says Rav Amital, when it comes to the Holocaust, Ani Omeid Lefnei Kir. I stand before a wall. Ani Kol Hazman Mitkotet HaKadosh Baruch Hu Al Ma Shekara. I always struggle with God. I always fight with Him about this issue. He says, of course, sometimes I have difficulty davening. Many years, he says, I didn't talk about the Shoah, but then as the years went on, I started to talk about it more. And I do struggle. There's not a day that goes by, he says, that I don't think about the Holocaust. So, years ago, go to page 10. I didn't give you the whole thing because it's a little bit long, so I only gave you 4 pages. This was a talk that Rav Amital delivered in Yeshivat Har Etzion. It's not verbatim, but it's a summary from one of his students. This was delivered in 1998. So the title of this, which you can find online, but I gave it to you, I skipped the first 2 paragraphs, just the first 2 pages. So the bottom here on page 10, he's quoting from the Chovos HaLevavos of Rav Bachi Ibn Pakuda, which is a very important and fundamental religious text. It's about the basis of the service of God. Pathways and understandings, the core of our service of God. So Rav Amital here is quoting from Chovos HaLevavos, the notion that our service of God is predicated on gratitude, what we call Hakarat HaTov, gratitude. And this approach is developed by many contemporary rabbis and thinkers. So we're going to take a few minutes now to go through this piece and understand how Rav Amital, I'm not speaking for Rav Amital in his entirety, because there's a whole book from Moshe Maya just analyzing Rav Amital's perspectives on the Holocaust, because he spoke about it many times, and I wouldn't even claim to understand a crumb of what Rav Amital really thought. I'm just going to read with you what it says. Not more, not less. That's what it is. This is his own reflection as it was transcribed. Okay, the question is, who wants to start reading? I'm going to start. Okay, Jenny, go ahead. Last line.
The question is, understandably, answer the awesome devastation of the Jewish people in the Holocaust. How, if at all, can we still talk about our worship of God being based on gratitude or recognition of God's grace? On my first Yom Kippur, after being liberated from a Nazi labor camp, I prayed with other survivors in a camp cellar. I could not fully describe the storm of emotion that I felt then, but I will try to reconstruct some of that feeling. I was young then. I had no children. My parents had been murdered along with most of the population of our town. Among the survivors in that small room, there were people who had lost their children, parents, spouses, and siblings. They prayed, and I with them. Was their worship of God based on gratitude? Can a Jew who has lost his wife and children possibly serve God on the basis of recognition of his kindness? Can a Jew whose job was the removal of the charred remains of corpses from the crematoria of Auschwitz be capable of serving God on the basis of gratitude? No, not in any way, shape, or form. But where, then, does that leave us?
Okay, thank you. So the next paragraph, Rav Amital invokes a passage in the Talmud where there is an unbelievably awe-shaking description of a back and forth between great prophets and God. Because originally, the men of the great assembly, they composed the prayers that we have today, what we call the Shemona Esrei, our blessings, our brachot. They're comprised by the men of the great assembly. Their composition, the Gemara says, was they were great in their accomplishment. How? Because they set up the order of the prayers. Well, what was so unusual about the order of the prayers? Well, there was something that was unusual because before they came along, the prayers were not the way they were. Why? Because the prayers, as we say, is Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, Vahanora. Those are the four descriptions of God that we give in the beginning of the silent service. When we converse with God, we say God is the master, the great, Gadol, Gibor, mighty, and awesome. So the Talmud says that when the first temple was destroyed, there was a prophet. Who was the prophet of destruction at the time of the first temple? That's right, Yirmiyahu, the prophet Jeremiah. He says, you see these people? You see the Babylonians? They wrecked your house. They destroyed our community. They ruined our land. Where is the awesomeness of God? Aye no rosav. So you know what Yirmiyahu said? Take it out. So they took it out of the text. This is proverbial. They didn't have a text back then. They didn't have a siddur. It was only said from the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. But the idea was, Yirmiyahu says, we can't say that. And then came Daniel. He says, we can't say Hagibor. And the Anshei Knesset HaGedola returned it. And that's the back and forth. That's the back and forth in this discussion. But what does Rav Amital take from this? He said, you know what God hates? He hates insincerity. He hates flattery. What in Hebrew is called chanifa, right? Am I correct here? All right, Cecilia says I'm on the button. Okay, it's good. Chanufa, that usually means insincere flattery when you're trying to curry favor with somebody. It is a very, very negative connotation. This behavior is abhorrent to God, Rav Amital says. It's terrible. They told the truth, the prophets. Next page. Okay, continue. Go ahead. Go to top of the 12th. Divine service.
They told the truth. Oh, divine service must be built on truth, not on falsehood or fawning flattery. Therefore, the prophets who felt that attributes such as the great, the mighty, or the awesome could be used accurately to describe God refrained from using such terms, despite the fact that they realized that they were deviating from the Torah's language and from the text that Moshe had instituted. This is also true of our issue. Within the era that saw the greatest destruction in the history of the Jewish people, it is impossible to base our divine worship on the foundation of recognition of his good. Of course, we must always remain aware of God's daily acts of kindness and must sincerely pray, Modim Anaf Nulaf. We thank you for your wonders and kindness at all times, evening, morning, and afternoon. But while gratitude should certainly constitute one component of our divine service, it cannot serve as the entire foundation of our worship. Rabbeinu Bathya, in the 10th section of his Chavos HaLevavot.
So this is the same work that he was referencing earlier. So think about this now as you're putting it together in your mind. There was one path of connecting to God that was through gratitude, through appreciation within Rabbeinu Bachya. It's very limited now. So Rav Mital says, don't leave. There's another path. That first path still remains, albeit muted, but now look at the second path. What's the second path?
The gate of love of God sets out a different path of divine service. One of the pious men would rise in the middle of the night and declare, my God, you have starved me, you have left me naked, you have set me to dwell in the gloom of night, and you have taught me your strength and your greatness. If you incinerate me in flame, I will continue only to love you and rejoice in you. It is as...
So, what is this idea? It's unbelievable. It's transcending the suffering. It's saying, yes, the suffering is from you, God, but I still love you. Right? This is unbelievable. This is of the highest of the high. He quotes it then from Eov. And then the idea of loving God even in the period of divine concealment. He quotes this Mishnah in Sota. Let's go down to that. This is the Mishnah in Sota. Go down second to last paragraph.
On that very day, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hyrcanus preached, Eov serves God solely out of love.
What happened to Eov? Eov had terrible, awesome, awful suffering, but he still served God. What did he serve God out of? Not out of gratitude, but out of a profound love and a connection. Go ahead.
As it says, even if he kills me, I will still trust in him. The Gemara Sota adds that it is only possible to explain the verse the way it is read, not according to the way it is written. Thus, the word lo in the verse, Hein Yitzalenu lo ayachel, is to be spelled lamed vav, yielding the translation above. It is impossible to interpret the verse as it is written, with the word lo spelled lamed aleph, yielding the translation, if he killed me, I will no longer trust in him.
Ah, right? So what's the challenge that the word lo is spelled with an aleph? For a person to say, I deny the lo with the aleph and I still say lo with the vav, I'm still his. It's the lo with the vav. We do not have lo, and this is, it's inexplicable. But this is the core of our Judaism. This is the core of our connection to God. That is an unbroken spirit. We do not know how to explain this dveikut. Dveikut means clinging, connection. But it is a bond, Rav Amital says, that lies at the core of our very being. This is the key line of the whole Shtickel Torah. This line. You ready? Go ahead.
This is also the explanation of the verse.
Let's skip to the next paragraph. Let's just do this one line.
In the wake of the Shoah, to whom can we still flee?
This is it. You ready? If you haven't underlined it yet, this is it. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I keep interrupting. I'm too excited.
The answer is clear. We have fled from you to you.
Pierre, that's the answer. They fled from him to him. There is a Rambam, a comment of Maimonides, in the Pirush HaMishnayos, in his commentary on the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah, where he talks about the dread of the days of awe. And according to the Kapach translation, the way that it's read, the way that it's understood, the Rambam says the following, that it's a day of trembling, of fear, of umonos, of fleeing, umivrach, and running away, umivrach, running, a love to him. We're running from him, and we're running to him. That's the paradox, but that's the answer. It's to be able to still live in a state, in a place, in a way that Rav Amital says, we felt that we were running from him, but we were running to him. That's how he lived his whole life. And I want to conclude and show you that he was not the only one who lived like this. There's another man who was also a survivor, who Rav Amital knew, who articulated the exact same thing in a different way. His name was Elie Wiesel. Turn the page. Years ago, Elie Wiesel, Zichrono Livracha, did an interview with Krista Tippett. How many of you have heard of Krista Tippett? NPR, On Being. Okay, good. She's a very interesting personality. She has a book that I have. It's called Conversations with God, or God, Einstein's God, something like that. She's a very, very spiritual person. I think she's not Jewish. And she used to have a radio show on NPR called Speaking of Faith, or Speaking About Faith. And then that morphed into... Yeah, okay, good. And then it morphed into what is currently, it's a podcast, and it's a piece on NPR called On Being. On Being. Oh, you like it? Oh, great.
Wednesday nights.
Or you can get it online anytime. So years ago, in 2006, at that time it was still called Speaking of Faith, it was conversations about people of faith. So she interviewed Elie Wiesel. She has a lot of things to say in this interview. I cut out most of it, but I wanted you to have a piece of the transcript from Elie Wiesel. Go to the fourth paragraph here. Some people who read my first book, Night, they were convinced that I broke with the faith and broke with God. Not at all. I never divorced God. It is because I believed in God that I was angry at God, and still am. But my faith is tested, wounded, but it's here. So whatever I say, it's always from inside faith. Even when I speak the way occasionally I do about the problems I had, questions I had, within my traditions, you know, it is permitted to question God, even to take him to task. Quarreling with God, that's Krista Tippett. Yeah, we may. It's even more than that, you know. It is suing God. The expression is really suing God. That's the expression in Hebrew. Hebrew, yeah. I sue God in Hebrew. I bring him to rabbinic tribunal. And the arguments are all the arguments I take from the Bible and his words. I mean, I take God's words and say, since you said these words, how is it possible that other things have happened? It's because you take God so seriously that you ask. Go down about a few paragraphs. So as I was preparing to meet you, this is Krista Tippett speaking, I looked through a number of your books again, some that I've read, some that I hadn't, and then I ended up going back to Night, which you can see has lost its cover a few years ago, which you have also said was the primary text that everything else you've written and said is commentary on this. And you know, this question that you've addressed of your loss of faith, I think comes especially from this famous passage, and then she reads the passage. So what happens afterwards, she asks him. So look at the next section. What happened after is in the book. I went on praying. So I have said these terrible words, and I stand by every word I said. But afterwards, I went on praying. I described Rosh Hashanah, the Kaddish, everything. I went on praying. I went on praying. Can read the rest on your own. Who is he praying to? Who is he running to? He was running back to him. So, Umanos Umivrach Elov. Elie Wiesel says to the Ribbono Shel Olam, he says to God, I run from you, I have challenges, I have questions, but I run to you. I pray to you. This is what he then goes on. He talks about his father and his tradition and his Yom Kippur and his Rosh Hashanah and his whole life. Our hope in our lives today is that we can take some of this and pay it forward and share it with others. Because everybody
goes through challenges, lo aleinu. We should never know from such things. And the challenge that we find is how to feel God in those circumstances when we feel like we're running away from Him. So what Rav Amital taught us, and what Elie Wiesel taught us, and what all the stories that we started with, what are the stories trying to convey? This same point. That on the one hand, we run from you, but really, we run to you. Shana Tova.
Thank you.